I'm trained as a population geneticist, which has a lot of theory about trying to make predictions, and also as a physiologist. And I would say my kind of philosophy or approach is really at the level of the organism. So the organism is an organizing feature for me of biology. And so today, what I'd like to talk about is how processes in starting at the genomes of organisms scale up through the organism and impact evolution. And also, I'll talk about a little ecology at the end, which I've never talked about before. Which is funny, it's sort of the reverse. Mike was an ecologist and then became an evolutionary biologist. So I'm going to talk about, loosely, the complex genetics of energetics. And I want to motivate a little bit why we should care about complex genetics. So yesterday, we got a great introduction into the selective effects of mutations and the dynamics of those selective effects when they're close to this area where drift can dominate and selection can really not be as deterministic as we think it should be, and where drift can really take over. And so so there will be mutations out there that have large selective effects, and selection will see them and selection will fix them. But those aren't the mutations that we necessarily expect to be the mutations when we go out to a population of organisms and we sample those populations. And those populations are the units on which selection is operating. And I would argue that the mutations also for energetics we might not expect to be very strong effects. And if they are strong effect, they might actually be bad and be removed by selection. So when we go out to populations and we're thinking about the types of mutations that are going to arise and affect metabolism, I think we're looking at those mutations that are sitting near those drift barriers. All right, and so that means it's really important to think about how strong their selective effects are and how often those selective effects are manifest across the different environments that that allele will find it in. So yesterday when we talked about S, that really important thing, that selective effect, and its relationship to the affected population size, we sort of treated that S as being something that was constant. And what I'm going to talk about today is how complex genetics means that that S is not always constant across the environments that that mutation finds itself in. And that environment can be the physical environment. It could be the biotic environment of like the microbiome or how an organism interacts with a pathogen or predator-prey. But it could also be the internal environment, so the sex of the organism, and even the genetic background that that mutation arises in. And so that's sort of complex genetics. It's when the effects of a mutation become condition dependent on a lot of different things. And I really think that the mutations of energetics, we expect them to have these types of dynamics, but I'll also show you data that they are complex. All right, an organizing framework, visual, conceptual model that we use in evolutionary genetics is the genotype. You've probably heard of, how many of you have heard of the genotype-phenotype map? There's a lot of money right now to study the genotype-phenotype map. So we're going to talk about what that thing is. And then also there's this other map, and that's the phenotype to fitness map. So I want to sort of bring those to your attention, but also with the caveat that they're really not... they're kind of things we can use to visualize it, but it's not always clear how that really relates to the actual map that we're mapping. So we often see it like this, and in fact, Lewontin in his book, which is a great book if you want a book to read on the genetic basis of evolutionary change, it's a really, I think it's a pleasant read, even if you're not a biologist. This is loosely based on his, although it didn't have developmental space. And so it basically says, individuals might find themselves in some, this is clearly multidimensional, here it's just two, but you find yourself in some space, and that space should somehow determine your phenotypic space for the genotypic space that has an effect on that trait. And what we're really measuring typically from an empirical standpoint is a differential here. So we're typically measuring, this genotype relative to this genotype. Or for genetic variation, we might be sampling across that space. And then up here, we also have we're measuring things sort of relative to each other. And so really, what we're often doing is we're saying a particular difference in genotype gives us a particular difference in phenotype space. And we call that a map, but really what we're measuring are kind of differences here, and how those associate with differences here.
Okay, so what relates the genotype space to the phenotype space? Well, the development of the organism, the physiology of the organism. Here I've not even told you like at what level this phenotype is.
So the map you mentioned assumes that nothing changes as you go from genotype to phenotype, right?
No, everything can change between genotype and phenotype, yeah.
Point. Yeah. So if you just looked at the differential here and the differential there, there are a lot, it's an open system. So there are a lot of things coming in and leaving. So that map could just be the noise drowned out in a lot of the other external signals coming.
Certainly, I would say it's an open system, and I probably use those words wrong in this room because I've only been to KITP once, so I actually don't know which words I'm using incorrectly. Certainly, there are. I'll try to use them correctly in the biological world. Whether I'm using them right in the physics world, I'll show you a lot of data where that genotype to phenotype relationship does change as a function of, for example, the developmental environment of the organism. So yes, I'm going to show you actually quite a lot of data that these arrows change. And even things that in one environment look strongly associated with a trait, in another environment can actually not be associated at all and look like there would be kind of a neutral effect of any of those genotypes.
So we all heard about the G space and the P space. The developmental space, to me, is a new one. But also, if you think about development, we think about time. And space, where's time here?
Yeah, actually, this is... So one of my strongest forays into trying to apply some real, like, it's like engineering math to developmental processes with an engineer named Noah Cohen at... he's at Johns Hopkins. He works on very fast dynamics, so like the ability of an insect to turn quickly. And I was like, well, let's try to take some of that. It's like a lot of feedback inhibition, and let's try to apply it to development. And it like the time difference makes a big difference. So yeah, we need to think about a few time scales when we're thinking about this, and one of them is developmental time, and then of course evolutionary time. I'm going to talk about stages a lot and actually show you that across development there's. This is really important for energetics. People have talked about, this is Waddington's developmental landscape. Now I have to think about like tornadoes and vortexes on that landscape because I saw, we kind of, Professor Wang went through that slide, but apparently has done some work on sort of forces on these landscapes. It's the Waddington's idea. Down here is actually the other picture. This is the one you often see, but this is also in the paper. You know, this is in 1957, and this is sort of him thinking about how is that constructed. And it's sort of this idea that there were genes pulling together in an interactive way to generate a complex landscape. And what this landscape indicates is there could be stochasticity up here, there could be genetic effects, mutations, and they're going to put you into one of these channels. But then once you go down there can be some noise in the system and you'll still develop into that space. It kind of suggests that there might be discrete spaces that could be the endpoint of development. So that is a very, like, I mean, that was a conceptual model.
Could I ask a question about the Lewontin book? I've never read it, but as someone who's not a biologist, I'm always looking for a reliable guide to the biological literature. And I guess I've always avoided Lewontin for reasons that may not be, I don't want to do character assassination or anything, but I've read some of his things and I thought they were completely off base. Like, he didn't seem to understand what neutral theory was about in one of the things I read. He criticized it very strongly for reasons that seemed facetious and he seemed to, and other things, another thing I read, he came to the defense of Stephen Jay Gould with defending things I thought were ridiculous.
They were colleagues, so there's, you know, there was probably some.
So I wonder if there's, is there a more nuanced, I mean, I accept what you're saying, this may be a great book, and maybe I'm a little too, you know, making generalizations where I shouldn't about not reading his stuff, and I wondered if you had some opinion
about
it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of times in my graduate class, I have the students read this, because this is a really early, I mean, 1974, right, this is a really early recognition of the presence of genetic variation that people didn't think was supposed to exist. You know, it's been a while since I've read the whole thing completely. I don't find anything in this book particularly controversial, although, I don't know, what's your take on this book?
Well, there's some truth in what Greg says. But,
and this is historical, too. I mean, it's like a classical.
The time was sort of a path changer, because you summarize. People didn't know how much genetic variation was, and at the molecular level, he was in the right place at the right time, I guess, and a pretty good writer. And
he's a good writer.
And summarized our knowledge at the time, but you know, he's been wrong, like all of us.
I think some of the questions he poses in the beginning of that book are still questions that people in evolutionary biology are interested in. And so from that perspective, you're like, oh, 74 seems like a long time ago.
Okay.
We still haven't answered all the questions.
Thank you.
So then once you're in the phenotype space, you can draw the fitness landscape. And the fitness landscape, I mean, it's just like an iconic thing in evolutionary biology. And yet it's something that really you can draw it. Those axes can be so many things. And so many times it's a cartoon, you know, so here is right space where you're looking at contour plots and envisioning a population that moves along this space over time, governed by directional forces like selection and stochastic forces like drift, and also vortexes and tornadoes on that landscape. All right, so that was Wright's picture from his paper. This is a more recent paper. This is a study on beta-lactamase. So this is a well-studied protein for antibiotic resistance, but also as a model for protein evolution. And so what these authors envision is a sequence space now. So, you know, Wright was maybe thinking about both. I mean, this is early, so it's like we don't really understand the gene yet. So, you know, it's sort of thinking about genetics or maybe, and but probably phenotypes. But you can draw it for any traits. Those can be genetic traits. Those can be phenotypic traits. And the thing about the landscape that I think has captured the hearts of evolutionary geneticists is that it presents some obstacles to evolution. So if your population is up here, well, how are you ever going to get to this other peak, which appears to be a better place to be? That's the fitness optimum. So fitness is always the z-axis. And so what these authors are showing through a rather cartoon-like diagram is that, well, maybe some... Oh, and I guess I should point out, because you don't expect to go through a fitness valley if selection is working well, although drift clearly can take you into those places. So you can imagine, though, that in a different environment, the landscape is different. So under different environmental conditions, the relationship between genes, phenotypes, and fitness can change. And so maybe then when the environment changes, that actually provides a directional path up to that fitness optimum.
I have a question.
And it could flop back.
I have a question. So you have two white dots which represent...
Populations.
Population. Now, when you get there at the phenotype, what are you looking for? In other words, what was relevant at the gene level, unless it's a disease or an illness, some manifestation at the phenotype level. It's a complexity problem, right? Because it could be combined in different ways, it could manifest in different ways.
Yep.
How would you know what to look for in that map?
So this map on the z-axis, when you're conceptualizing it, is going to be this thing. It's called fitness. Fitness is a really complicated thing to measure. I'm going to show you a few examples of how we measure it, and including one being the population growth rate, which is something I've only recently measured. But let me, speaking to that, I wanted to show you that we often see these pictures, all right? But I'm not, like... in some ways, it's kind of like a cartoon. and so what are we really, like, if we have organisms, what can we measure? So I wanted to show you maybe a fitness landscape. It's not as dramatic. I think it's pretty. This is, like, from data. These are some data I collected. So I collected these quite a while ago, and what I did is I'm interested in how organisms survive in the presence of ethanol. And for a fruit fly, that's their native environment. So fruit flies have pretty impressive ethanol tolerance. And so I can measure that. So this plot comes from hundreds of individuals that are of different genotypes. So there's genetic variation. And I can measure quite well their ethanol tolerance. So that's a measure of fitness. You know, that's how well...
Are those Michaelis Menten?
I'm going to tell you.
Wait, okay.
Yep. So this, I'm telling you, this axis here, it's survival in the presence of ethanol in your environment, which we think of as a relevant measure of fitness, but it's not the only thing, right? Fitness is going to be really complex.
In some relative sense, like relative to something?
These actually are LD50s. That's the percentage of ethanol that gives you a 50% chance of death, in this case in 48 hours. So that's actually a lot of my axes will be relative, so you'll scale to the mean. But this is actually absolute. These are Vmaxes. So you grind up the flies, and you take the whole enzyme homogenate, and you run a biochemical assay that just gives you Vmax. And so you could, and so what I did is I actually did that for three different enzymes. So ethanol has a pretty simple breakdown pathway. We do it the same way. I know, you turned off my light.
Sorry.
It's actually a linear pathway. I'm going to draw a curve just so I don't go behind the board. Yeah, it's okay. I think it's okay. I mean, I'm not going to show you any like confocal microscopy or anything today. So, all right. So this is the basic pathway that breaks down ethanol. It takes something relatively toxic, it makes something actually more toxic, gives you hangovers. This is actually not great to have around in your cells either. But at the end of the day, you get something really good. And this is presumably why flies have evolved high ethanol tolerance, is that they can take advantage of something in their environment that other organisms can't and convert it into something that you can make lipids from. It's like why we shouldn't drink too much, because we both can get hungover, but also we can get fat. So you can measure all the enzyme activities along here. And I did that. It's actually one of the few, I'm showing you sort of old data, and I can actually say I did it because I actually did this. And you can write down, this is simple, from Michaelis-Menten kinetics, you can just write down the equation that predicts flux through the whole pathway. And then you can just make the assumption that your survival in the presence of ethanol is related in some way that you don't know to flux through this pathway.
I forgot which one that's supposed to be the Asians.
ALDH.
Okay.
ALDH2 is the human one that has the polymorphism. Flies have actually polymorphisms in ALDH2. Seem like they affect the trait. So one of the things about this pathway is that while you have some strong predictions that things like flux through each step should matter, if I just take the data I have in hand and I try to do a correlation, none of these single steps correlate with ethanol tolerance very well. So the idea here is that, well, maybe it's actually coming not just through single steps, but through the whole, like you really need to get ethanol through the whole pathway. And so when I fit the function, so I just say, take my data on LD50, and I fit an equation that ends up, I've only really measured, like in the Michaelis-Menten equation, I haven't measured substrates, I haven't measured KMs, I haven't measured KCATs, all I have is Vmax. But you can still fit this equation that ends up looking something like this. Each of these has a different. And actually, this one ends up just doesn't seem like it matters. And you get some, end up estimating some coefficients for these that are about 0.8. And that's what I'm plotting here. It's just what that equation. So I just, well, I fit this, I've used some different ways to do it, but actually you can just use like a nonlinear regression fitting, and you can plot that surface. Okay, so why was that a useful thing for me to do? It actually predicts ethanol tolerance really well, whereas the single steps don't. And what that tells you already is that we learn more by studying the output of that system than we do from a single step.
So you are assuming the death correspond is the same as the flux, or what is the harmful product that causes death?
Actually, multiple. Oh, okay. So actually, I'm gonna just All give right. me a sec. So you might ask, well, what kind of biology do we get from that surface? What does it mean? And what it means is that if you look at the surface, you can have, as a fly, a really high ADH activity. But if you have low downstream activity here at ACS, then you have low survival. And that makes sense because the things that build up in the middle, acetate and acetaldehyde, are really not good for cells. And so this sort of shows that you really expect that those enzymes should be evolving together. It should be sort of coevolution to have positive covariance between those enzymes and populations. So that's what we can sort of, we can conceptualize it, and it's great, and people do, I shouldn't say it's all conceptual, because people do great modeling of this. From an empirical standpoint, in a multicellular organism, you can do something like this. And I think that that's an important thing to do, and need to do more of it. So that was kind of an overall motivation for...
How many dots are there on that surface, usually?
Oh, like for my data?
For example.
My data has about 100 data points that come from different genotypes and actually different conditions. So that landscape is incorporating variation that comes from genes and also environment. So a lot of times to get these landscapes, you kind of have to have a big range on the axes. And so we did that in that experiment through modifying and keeping track of genetic and environmental variation. If you want to know what environments and why I chose them and you like membrane dynamics, we can talk on a chalkboard afterwards. Okay, so this is my sort of like organizing principle in the lab, and pretty much everything I do is that, you know, genetic variation is going to impact fitness, and to do that, it's going to impact some performance phenotypes, that things that organisms do in their environment, and in my worldview, that's all underlain by energetics. So the processes by which organisms can do stuff, right? They have to build things, they have to, you know, burn ATP, as we've been talking about, and that's all driven in eukaryotic multicellular organisms by a beautiful pathway of enzymes coupled with oxidative phosphorylation in the mitochondria. So I try to understand actually both directions. I try to understand, well, and I guess I should back up and just say, like, a lot of people who study genotype-phenotype do it from an association mapping perspective. Like, I just try to figure out, I scan the whole genome and try to figure out what SNPs are associated with what traits, which is fine. And what people learn is that that's actually really complex, but we don't understand the complexity.
Could you define a SNP?
Oh, yeah, sorry. A mutation in a population. A single nucleotide polymorphism. Yeah, good. So I can talk about, I actually thought about talking about giving a talk on mapping, but if people are interested in mapping approaches and kind of what we're doing in humans, then I'm totally love to do that on a chalkboard. I won't do it in this talk.
Could you just elaborate on that? So like in your mind, kind of like pros and cons of doing stuff, which is like, you know, kind of a mapping-based approach versus a non-mapping-based approach to getting at these same questions?
I like both. I think you get different things. The approach, everything I'll show you today is very much from a mapper's perspective. I like to, like, map the stuff, know what the genes are, and then know what they're doing. So that relies heavily on using, I guess it's a very functional approach. But I also, work in systems that are probably more amenable to doing something like scanning the genome in a population. So basically working at the level of, like, what's the variation look like in the genome, and from that can I infer how selection has operated on the genome. I think they're both valid approaches. If you're interested in mechanisms, then I think the former way, kind of what I'm going to present today, is really maybe a better way to understand, particularly if the question, and this is why I chose to present it at this group, if the question is, what do we gain from taking a really... for having a good theoretical understanding of molecular dynamics and, like, applying that or trying to link it with evolutionary process, I think we need to understand what the mechanisms are
that take that molecular dynamics and scale it up to the organism.
You've got to be careful. What do you mean by molecular dynamics?
Yeah, actually, that was one of the words you'll see. I was going to have a thing about that.
Okay.
So hold on.
You mean very different things here.
Yeah, we'll talk. I'll tell you what I mean by that.
I just want to clarify a basic point. The role of the environment here, based on your answer to the previous question, is that this genotype-phenotype fitness map is defined across all possible environments of thinking.
I suppose you could do an average, but usually I would argue that you want to define that map under different environmental conditions.
Per environmental condition. But the data on your landscape was pulled from many environments.
In mine? I did, and you can see where you could actually put the points on there that show you under what environmental conditions the population of lines find themselves. But to get the full landscape, you might need to, yeah, in my case, I did need to use environment too. Yeah. All right, so I put a fly here because the fruit fly is just, it's the best genetic organism out there. Sorry, Dennis. it's just a great, for somebody who really likes to study physiological performance, you know, it's a multicellular organism, it's got great development, it flies, you know, it does, I mean, it's really, it loves ethanol, it's a great organism to work with. It's not the only organism I work on. So we have a number, we kind of use this framework to answer lots of different questions, and so I just wanted to give you a flavor. Like, for example, we can ask how climate change impacts survival of overwintering insects, how sexual reproduction shapes genome evolution using these famous snails that I could talk about at some other point. And even now, some paramecium work answering what governs metabolic scaling relationships and how does thermal performance evolve. But they all really come back to this, is trying to understand how genes impact fitness, because that's how evolution happens. And I guess that I wanted to set up a little bit of a contrast. What we saw yesterday from a lot of the work that Mike shows is really looking broad, what are the broad principles of mutation and drift and selection that give us these patterns? And from that, can we learn something about how things like mutation rate evolves? The type of evolution that I'm really focused on lives a little bit in the noise space around a lot of those graphs we saw yesterday, and that is, how do populations within a species adapt to their local environments, and how do species that are closely related to each other, meaning they have very similar sizes and effective population sizes, how do they diverge from each other? So it's sort of a layer on top of what you saw yesterday. But all the same basic principles apply. Okay, so seeing how these talks have gone in the past, I thought maybe I should just give you my take-home points at the beginning. And I'm going to actually tell you what I mean by molecular dynamics. And so I'll just say what I've already kind of motivated with, but I'm going to give you the data, I think, to prove it. Is that I probably shouldn't use the word proof in this room either. An energetic framework provides, it's going to let us see some mechanistic insight on why that genotype-phenotype fitness map is even more complex than what you're led to believe with those pictures, which already kind of look complex. I'm going to just go through a lot of different sort of cherry-picked data, just based on conversations I've had that might appeal to some of you and give us something to talk about for the next few weeks. Well, if you want to come talk to me. And then, but I like to sometimes zoom out a little bit because I can get a little bit into the weeds of genes and energetic processes and sometimes step back and ask, does it matter at the organismal level? So do molecular energetic processes and the cost of those processes, are they big enough to matter at the organismal level, and how do they impact something that's happening at the evolutionary scale? So I'll show you just a couple patterns from our data that suggest that yes, they do. And then just really leave you with the idea that it's important that we start scaling up from the molecular physiology of energetic processes to tissue, organismal, and population levels. And if we want to, so this was just what I've seen over the last few days, and maybe molecular dynamics is the wrong word, you seem to be wanting to apply theory on energy transformation to the ways molecules are working in cells, from RNA to proteins to enzymes. If we're going to link that to evolution, we really have to know how those processes start scaling up. And that's, I mean, that's really hard. That's going to be the hard part, I think.
Okay, so here's the general outline of the data that I'll show you. I'm actually going to start with my very first paper, which I can't even remember the last time I talked about this data. I'm going to start with my first paper, and I'm going to end with some data that, like, really I just got plots of in the last few days from my lab. So we're sort of going to, like, go through a lot of different things. We're going to start by just empirical evidence for a complex genetic phenotype fitness relationship. I'm going to give you a case study where we understand the genetics really well, and we've worked out a lot of physiology. And that involves an interesting dynamic, which is the interaction between the mitochondrial genome and the nuclear genome. And I'll talk about why mutations have condition-dependent effects, and I think it's largely because of energy demand. And that energy demand differs when individuals find them in different environments. And then I'll show you two patterns, one at the level of genome evolution, and another looking at energetic costs of gene expression and how those affect organismal metabolic rate. And then I'll end with our sort of foray into understanding how energetics scales up to population growth rate. Okay, so these are data. I collected them. It's my very first publication in genetics. And I went to grad school in 1998, and a book came out. It was Lynch and Walsh. And I got to grad school, and I read the whole thing, cover to cover. I actually don't always recommend reading that book cover to cover, but I did it. And actually, I just want to take a minute. You don't often get to give a talk in front of somebody whose work has been so foundational for you, but if anyone's sort of looked at my CV, a lot of what I've done, the foundational information and books that I've read have come from Mike. So just want to thank Mike for his contributions. So I decided to map stuff after reading this book. If you don't know, it is all about quantitative genetics and how you map stuff. And I have been mapping stuff ever since. And so I got to the lab, this is pre-genomics. We didn't have a fly genome. People were just starting to use an approach called quantitative trait locus mapping. And I had a training in physiology, and I had a kind of crazy idea, which was to measure a ton of physiological traits and try to do QTL mapping. So I wanted to locate the positions in the genomes that harbored genetic variation for some metabolic enzymes that I measured, for metabolic rate, which I don't really have a picture of, and for flight performance. So I flew flies in a tracking system where I could track individual flies freely. So they're just flying freely. So you get kind of three-dimensional information, and you can get things like the angle at which they fly. Turns out there's genetic variation for the angle in which flies fly, and also for their velocity. And then I wanted to not just map it, but have some, like, this was my dream, is I'd have some, like, ability to say there's a place in the genome that affects global flux that affects flight. That was, like, thought that would be so cool.
What do you mean by the angle?
Yeah, so you can ask in what, what's the average angle of the flight path that they take? Yeah, because here, so much work had been done on tethered flies. Obviously, it's easier because you can measure force, and it's just a much more elegant system. But I was like, well, but they're not normally tethered, so let's just fly them free and see what they do. I was, 20 years old and thought I could do everything. Okay, so these are QTL maps. All genetic mapping is essentially, it's super simple. You have a marker in the genome, and you know its position. It has two or three states. In my case, they're going to be called OR and 2B. That's just representing that the nucleotide at that marker position differs between usually two states in your mapping. And you have some trait, and you can measure it, and you get some plot points. You can take all your individuals at every marker and categorize them by their genotype and ask, is there a difference in phenotype? And there's lots of different ways to do it, but that's essentially what mapping does. In this case, I'm measuring it with a likelihood ratio, and that likelihood ratio is bigger where there's a statistical association between the trait and the genotype. And you can slide along. In this case, the flies have three major chromosomes and a little dot non-recombining chromosome that we kind of ignore.
It only has a few genes on it, but it doesn't recombine, so actually it's not great for mapping. All right, so the first thing is, okay, glycogen synthase. There is a gene for that in flies. So there's a gene, it makes a protein, it's an enzyme, and it's called glycogen synthase, and it has activity. And I've starred for you where it lives in the genome, and you'll notice that these are permutation significance thresholds. You'll notice that the place where the genetic variation that associates with the enzyme activity is not at the gene that encodes the enzyme.
Sorry, can you explain this a little bit more? So this is, again, you sometimes take flies and you make a lysate, and then you are looking at the activity of some particular chemical reaction.
It's a Vmax of an enzyme homogenate, so it's got possibly kinetic differences at the enzyme, although it doesn't map there. So these are probably things that have to do with either enzyme concentration, so regulation of the amount of enzymes, or other cofactors, allosteric cofactors, things like that. So yeah, whole fly homogenate. Another way to think about it is, what's the capacity for that reaction if you give it all the substrate it needs in a test tube?
It's like what you cared about was, like, you know, fly respiration rate. It's not necessarily obvious that, like, respiration rate of whole fly, you know, like the relation to that between respiration rate of lysate.
These in vitro assays that I tend to do, you can think of them as almost like a capacity. It's certainly not how that enzyme is running in the fly at any given time. It's more of a proxy for how much of that enzyme, I think it's a proxy for how much of the enzyme is in the fly. I'll tell you later whether it actually associates with the respiration rates.
Where did you get the x-axis? I didn't follow that.
This is a mapping distance. So in your mapping population, this is where I could use a chalkboard maybe later to talk about mapping, but it's the recombinational distance between the two genetic markers in my mapping population.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
What I'm asking is how you make a graph that goes with those positions. I missed that point.
Oh, how it's a continuous line?
Well, just everything about it. How do I do it? Flies, you have homogenate. I see that you do an enzymatic assay. That's fine.
Yeah, so at each of...
different genetically.
So at every marker, you know the distance between those markers through their recombination rate.
I agree with that too, but that still doesn't tell me how to make a plot of the...
of the likelihood ratio?
I'll forget it.
Oh, no, it's okay. So at every marker, I basically do a test for whether there's a difference in my trait at that marker, but actually I can impute the genotype between those positions based on the recombination rate and the flanking markers. So at every, I guess the other way to say this is, if you just did it at your marker positions, you would have a bunch of points that are the likelihood ratio that represents the association between the trait and the genotype. But we can impute for a bunch of positions that we don't know, we haven't scored, we can impute the genotypes. And so as you walk along the chromosome, you can calculate the likelihood ratio of those imputed genotypes being able to predict the phenotype. That?
So, okay, maybe I've...
Yeah, maybe somebody could help me.
Question. I mean, I'm not... So you say it doesn't happen at where the gene is. Where is the gene in this R-axis?
On all of them, the gene, the location of the gene, or if they have multiple genes for that enzyme.
Oh, in the star.
They're the stars.
Okay.
So in every example I show you here, the place where there's genetic variation that associates with my phenotype exists away from where we know the gene is located that encodes the enzyme. So that tells you that in a population, the genetic variation this is the genotype-phenotype map. The genotype-phenotype map in this case says that the genetic variation that governs that trait exists away from the actual gene that encodes the enzyme.
Does that mean if there's a mutation there, then you see that?
Yes. It means that my population, actually more formally, it means that my population has a mutation there, segregates a mutation there that has an effect on the trait.
This was 1998, so maybe part of it was confusing. What were the markers? You don't have whole genomes.
Yeah, we don't have whole genome sequence. They're actually genotyped using Sanger sequencing.
Actually, these are transposable elements. Insertions. Yeah, that are.
Possibly confusing here too.
Yeah.
So now with the genome, can you go back and say that, oh, there's a regulator for glycogen synthase at that peak?
Yeah, so there's potentially more information. I'll just say, I'm going to show you an example where we fine scale mapped. This is pretty big swaths of the genome that are linked physically through linkage disequilibrium to those markers. So there are a lot of things. Basically, they're pretty big parts of the genome. Robert, do you want to ask one more time?
No.
You sure? I feel like I'm just not.
No, we're just talking past each other.
Okay.
It's not helpful.
I can give a little mapping 101 at some point. All right. Okay, the other level of complexity is, well, first that tells you we didn't actually know where to look for the genetic variation. It exists, you know, and so the assumption there is that somehow there are positions in the genome that are not the enzymes themselves that interact with those enzymes. And so when you do these types of, that mapping I just showed you is a single locus approach, right? It's only asking whether at this position in the genome there are two genotypes, and those two genotypes have a different trait. All right, but you could ask, is there, when you build your model, you could actually ask, well, what's the effect conditional on every other position in the genome? So you can go and you can do sort of all pairwise interactions. That's actually, I mean, I did it. So you can do that. Most, when you hear about a genome, like GWAS in humans, those are still doing single associations. To do all pairwise interactions would be, I mean, it'd be huge. But yet we know that they're probably important. And I can show you here. You can take a single position. So this is a place where there's a locus where there's an association between the genotype and the trait. So you can see if you have organ as your genotype, you have a lower value of that trait than if you have the alternative genotype. And then if you look at a second locus, which is indicated by these two different lines here, there's an additive effect. So being the two alternative genotypes, you can kind of add up the effects of those two loci. So there are additive effects. But then you can see that there's also these interactive effects. And so in this case, if you have at the X chromosome QTL, whether you are organ or 2B, the actual direction of the effect is different if on the second chromosome you have this other genotype. Right? That's actually problematic for a one-dimensional screen because neither of those QTL will pop up, right? Because you really need to be conditioning on the other genotype to see it. So that means in a one-dimensional genome screen, in a mapping thing, you are potentially missing a lot of things because you aren't allowing for the fact that there are non-additive interactions. We call these epistasis in quantitative genetics, or G by G, maybe a term that you've seen. And those affect lots of things. Those affect enzyme activities, they affect the path velocity of the fly, and you can find them that affect metabolic rate as well. And oftentimes we see this phenomenon where in one genetic background, there's no effect. So if you focus on the difference between organ and 2B genotypes, you know, in a 2B background at this other QTL, there's no effect. But then when you switch the genotype there, there's an effect. So another way to say that is, like, if you're thinking about the way a mutation might impact fitness, you'd call this conditionally neutral. Sometimes there's no effect, and other times there is an effect.
So epistatic here just means that they're not affecting one another, right?
They're not. There's an interactive effect. There's non-additivity.
They're still correlated with one another.
Are they correlated with one another?
I mean, to me, like...
You need to know the information. One way to say it would be to predict the phenotype, you need to have information on genotype at both positions in the genome.
Okay, it's just confusing because, like, epistatic, linguistically, it would suggest that it only matters in one place, right?
Yeah, this is the problem with the word.
Yeah, so actually, I'm...
People have epistasis. This just means that two gene products are interacting, but in quantitative genetics,
yeah,
all we care about is, or you care about, is whether the interactions are not additive.
Yeah, I mean, I care about both.
It's totally statistical.
It's a statistical description. Usually, the problematic use of epistasis is between developmental geneticists and evolutionary geneticists. But I actually think you're using it in a different way that I'm not fully getting. I won't use epistasis very much. In fact, I just prefer to say it's a non-additive or genetic interaction.
Christy, can you go back to the last slide?
Yeah.
Thing on the bottom right?
Yeah.
So I'm a little confused by that. So on the left, if you have the or background, it makes a difference whether you have 2B or on the other.
At the other position, yeah.
Okay. So in one case, you've got one or and one 2B, right? But then if you go to the 2B background, it doesn't make a difference. So that mm-hmm. means or 2B is different from 2B or?
Yes. And I'm actually going to show you a lot of
two. Other things around those markers are different? Because, I mean, thinking about it naively, you've got one gene on one chromosome, one gene on the other chromosome. Does it matter which chromosome has which one?
I think here the you have to, at every marker, you can be one of two states. And I'm labeling those states as whether they come from the two parents in the mapping population. And so you could think of this as at one position, it's like maybe an A or a T change. At another position, right, it's a different, it could be a GC difference. And so what you're plotting here are the four, and in my case, everybody's homozygous. So these are the four two locus diploid genotypes. And it says that at one locus, the effect of changing those genotypes, it exists in one genetic background, but when you switch that genetic background, that effect will go away. And I'm going to actually show you in the next part of the talk with the case study, I'll show you where we actually know the nucleotides and we know what they do, which is maybe going to be more satisfying.
Two different markers.
Two different markers on two different positions.
Two different states of the same marker.
No, they're two different. They're two states. They're two ways of being at two different places in the genome. They're labeled by where the origin of those from the parental population. Okay, so one of the things that, this is similar to the ADH example I just gave you, is there's not very strong correlations between any single enzyme activities and the higher order traits I measured, metabolic rate and flight. It's a little disappointing. But then I started thinking, well, how can I start capturing something in a bit of an informed way about flux through this pathway? And so there's a branch point in this pathway, and it's an important one because this part of the branch is going to take those carbons down through to electron transport chain. This part is going to go towards glycogen storage, and this flux is going to go through the pentose phosphate shunt, which is oftentimes used for things like making the reducing equivalents for lipids. So I thought, well, that seems like an important place. And so I tried to summarize the covariation around that by taking principal components and then taking the weights of those principal components for each of my genetic lines for which I had data, using that as the trait. So that's basically mapping the covariation between those enzyme activities against genotype. And there's a quite strong QTL for that. It's actually one of the strongest QTLs in the experiment. And that QTL overlaps or is in a similar position to QTL for metabolic rate and flight velocity. So what that's really similar to the argument I made earlier, is that there's information in the covariation amongst or the flux through these pathways that may be predictive of higher order phenotypes. But the single enzymes are not very good predictors.
of
the branch point meaning ratios of activities of enzymes, or how does?
Yeah, I did a principal component analysis of the three. Yeah. I've also tried to draw out the, you'll appreciate this, I've tried to draw out the Michaelis-Menten equations for that branch point. It's tricky. I've tried to fit it with a number of different, like, MCMC sampling approaches. But that's why I'm really excited about your talk, because maybe I can use some of the math you've already done.
And so this map, so this is done the same as kind of G1, you basically take lots of flies. You see where the enzyme activity is higher and lower, and then this map tells you the genetic, at which point is there a biggest genetic difference between the flies?
Yes, it says that at this point, the if you categorize your individuals by their genotype, they have different weights of that principal component that describes the covariation around that branch point.
Can you do some like path analysis type thing to look at it as like, you know, like the branch part thing acting through metabolic rates to get to flight, or like?
Don't know. There is some correlation, positive correlation between metabolic rate and flight velocity. But all open questions. I mean, actually, the reason
that with your existing data, just kind of like condition on the metabolic rate and then see, does that like kill the association? You know,
Yeah, the other way to do that is there are actual, for the same type of mapping that I did here, like the statistical approach, you can actually use like multivariate dependent phenotypes. So yeah, you might be able to ask whether if I had them both in there, do I only end up, you know, mapping it to one of those traits? That's a good point. Okay, so why did I choose to show you data from like 2003?
So now do you know if those genes are actually in that QTL?
None of those genes are in that QTL. Yeah. None of those genes. So, you know, probably some sort of regulator is my guess. And no one's come to work with me on this. So this is actually where this project kind of ends, except that all of the questions, all of the results, the idea that there are trans-acting genetic variation to a gene, the fact that there are interactions, and the fact that there is quite a bit of complexity in going from that genetic variation up to the phenotype has, like, that just motivated pretty much everything that I work on.
I have the impression that probably people have done Hi-C and something like that at this point, and so I wonder whether or not you'd see these associations. Like, what I'm saying is, physically, is that peak a neighbor of the other peak? Are they physical?
You mean the genes? Are they like physically located together?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that this kind of nuclear architecture and like what is co-regulating enzymatic genes is. Yeah, you're right. There probably is.
Yeah. Like, for real, I think people have already done the Hi-C. So
in flies. These are flies.
Yeah, no, I know.
that's the beauty. It's like, oh, yeah, I could actually go look at that.
Yeah
that's a good idea.
And I guess kind of implicitly what I was wondering, and this is maybe to, like, touch a little bit, is if you go back to the other one, I mean, like, couldn't one possibly hypothesize that you have some flies which have, like, superactive muscles that use a lot of energy? And those flies fly fast, and that forces them to have a metabolic rate, and hence they have a larger flux. So it's not that you have a genetic... It's really the variation is really in the downstream stuff.
Yeah, and I should say that I'm kind of agnostic as to where the, like... I think that's a totally valid argument, yes. Yes, that basically you're asking, well, what's the driving force? Probably the wrong word to use again, but... And yeah, it could be that you know, flies that have high flight velocities have strong muscle performance, and that drives everything. You might even ask, like, we might think, is that good or bad? And this is actually where I feel like a lot of the predictive... I'll just say, like, in a lot of my experiments that I do not have a strong prediction on whether metabolic rate should go up or down.
But I guess, like, if that scenario is right, the metabolic rate kind of isn't the important thing. It's just kind of like going along for the ride.
The supporting. Yeah. You couldn't have that flight muscle without that energy. So I think oftentimes of energy metabolism as the supporting thing for performance. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so let's dive into a little bit more about mitochondria. So... and that's important, and the reason we're going to dive into mitochondria is it's both important for energetics, clearly. We've learned a lot about it already.
But from a genetic complexity point of view, we really a priori expect there to be genetic interactions that affect how the mitochondrial functions. And that's because the mitochondria has its own genome that produces gene products. Those gene products have to physically interact, like physically touch, gene products that come from the nuclear genome. It does that both to build the complexes that were really nicely described by Shelley on electron transport chains. So here I'm just, they're color-coded. So there are mitochondrial protein products. They have to interact with nuclear protein products, physical interactions between proteins. But then all of the transcription and translation also requires a lot of physical interactions between products that are being made in the two genomes. And I'm going to show you an example of one of those. So, you know, this functional interaction has made people posit that there's also a coevolutionary dynamic between these two genomes. So if you have substitutions in one genome that changed, for example, the conformation of this protein, does that place a pressure on these nuclear encoded proteins to compensate for those changes? And the reason that that model has really originally, I think, came up is that we know that animal mitochondria tend to have high substitution rates, and there's some evidence that those substitutions are deleterious. It's a genome that's totally linked, and that linkage we learned yesterday brings down the effective population size relative to the nuclear genome. So that means that those mutations that arise in the mitochondrial genome are going to be closer to that drift barrier. That means selection is not always going to get rid of the bad things, and selection also can't always fix the good things.
Which two genomes you're mentioning?
The mitochondrial genome uh-huh. is a small circular genome of bacterial origin inside the mitochondria, inside the organelle. And then the nuclear genome would be all the autosomal and sex chromosomes that are in the nucleus, in eukaryotes, I guess I should say.
So they encode the same enzymes at the same time?
No, they are different subunits. And it has all of its own tRNAs, and it has some of the components of the ribosome, but the rest of the ribosome comes from the nuclear genome. So there's like 1,000 products that come from the nuclear genome interacting with about 37 products in mitochondria. So there's been this coevolutionary dynamic proposed where you have mutations that arise in the mitochondrial genome, oftentimes probably bad, and that puts a selective pressure on the nuclear genome to fix compensatory things. So somebody mentioned, I think, the Red Queen dynamic. This is sort of similar. Those two genomes are posited to be co-evolving together, but mainly to stay in the same place, to keep respiration happening. Okay, so probably none of you read about mitonuclear coevolution, but there's been like this kind of boom in that area of research. And oftentimes, very much not from a theoretical standpoint, and very much from an adaptationist paradigm, I would say. Despite the fact that we know from a lot of work and theory that actually the mitochondrial mutations are probably deleterious. So I think it's an important area, and it's an area where there's a lot of misinformed things you could read, actually, right now in that area. You know, so what evidence do we actually have that this coevolutionary dynamic happens? And there's not very much of it. The evidence I put up here is great evidence, but it's pretty sparse. So there's some patterns from molecular evolution, and I'm going to show you some of my own patterns, so I'm not going to go into the details there. On organisms where we can, like single-celled things like yeast, where we can do good genetics, there's some great examples. Basically, this coevolutionary dynamic, if it plays out along lineages that are diverging from each other, so species or populations that are diverging from each other, and you have this coevolutionary dynamic where the mitochondrial and the nuclear genome have all these substitutions to keep them working well together, if you all of a sudden switch the mitochondria and you put it with its non-coevolved genome, it shouldn't function very well. That's like the basic functional consequence. And that's been shown in closely related yeast species, and actually sort of the maybe part of the best evidence of that this happens within populations, within species, comes from these great studies in the marine copepod Tigriopus, but pretty sparse. And so I decided, well, maybe we should tackle it with the greatest model organism ever.
So you made a statement that kind of want to say. So you're saying when the mitochondria makes the mutation it more likely to be the variants. Why is that?
Actually, there's two. That's a sort of a subtle question there. The first is a mutation that arises in the mitochondria more likely to be deleterious?
Right.
And the second one are the substitutions that we see more likely to be deleterious in the mitochondrial genome? And so it's sort of two timescales there. The first has to do with the distribution of selective effects of mutations, which I think Mike maybe mentioned or showed us yesterday. You know, the mitochondria in animal mitochondria has very little non-coding DNA. And because of mutation bias, this is sort of getting into the weeds a little bit, but it has strong mutation bias, which Mike has shown and which I've looked at too. And in some animal genomes, really the only mutations that you see arising because of their bias mutation from particular nucleotides to particular other nucleotides, it does seem that they often are arising in non-synonymous positions. That's certainly happening in flies. So I think that, yes, so in some animals it may be that the mutations that arise tend to have deleterious effects. The argument that I was making is that the substitutions that we see there, because of the reduced effective population size of the mitochondria, they'll more often sit near that drift barrier where you have deleterious substitutions, that deleterious mutations can't be removed by selection, and so they get fixed in the mitochondria.
But there's nothing to do with proofreading.
Why there's more mutations may have to do with proofreading. So mutation rates in mitochondrial genomes in animals can be like 35 times higher than your nuclear genome.
Okay, so that's got to be something to do with the proofreading.
Yeah, but that is not true across all. Actually, that's mammalian. I shouldn't say animals. Okay. That's mammalian. That rate varies. Actually quite a bit across animals for and plants for reasons that are still people are trying to figure out.
So there are two factors. One is from epistasis, the influence on the selection force, and the other one is coming from this mutational force. So you are arguing that the mutational one is probably dominating because of the near drift barrier. The selective force not in action.
I think it's hard. So one of the reasons I think it's hard is because I think a lot of mutations that land in the mitochondrial genome, like for example in flies, their selective effects are strong enough that we don't actually have to worry about the drift barrier. But I would say that the ratio of substitutions mitochondrial to nuclear, in mammals, that would be like 35-fold. But in Drosophila, for example, it's 2-fold. So the dynamic, there's a lot of phylogenetic variation. And actually, I'll show you, if we get to it, the genomic pattern, genome evolution pattern I'm going to show you, differs a lot between flies and mammals. And I think maybe because of that variation, and that could be arising through differences in the mutational bias, the distribution of selective effects that I think is maybe tied to that mutation bias, and for smaller selective effects, the effective population size of the mitochondria.
Because if you have interactions, you can have a red queen. I mean, but on the other hand, as you said, if you have a mutation like this, you could also have a red queen. Coming from different sources.
Yeah, and I'll just show you, it gets a lot more complex because S changes a lot on the environment. All right, so in a nutshell, we decided to use fly genetics to sample natural genetic variation that actually comes from both Drosophila melanogaster, that's the one you're probably, it's like the famous one, but Drosophila simulans is its sister, and we can get some hybridization to happen between these species. They have quite divergent, like some of these mitochondria are about 100 amino acids divergent from melanogaster. And using a lot of, it's like a combination of really brute force and really elegant genetics, we brought the mitochondria from these different species and from divergent melanogaster populations. We took 8 different mitochondria and we precisely placed them in organisms with two different nuclear backgrounds from melanogaster. So it's all natural variation. None of this is you know, mutants.
Can I ask a question? How should I think of these different mitochondria living in the same species? So it's like having different bacterial species, or is just a continuous variation? I don't know if the question makes sense, but so it's just
we've basically used a mom from a different species, and she has donated her cytoplasm, which carries her mitochondria, into melanogaster. So we took, you know, these are basically mitochondria that have about 100 amino acids different than the native mitochondria. We've like replaced their native mitochondria with a slightly divergent mitochondria. And what we are testing for is to see whether that messes stuff up.
I guess my question is, I mean, should I think of these different mitochondria like different strains of E. coli, or they are like...
Oh. I'm not a microbial phylogenetics person, so I would think that strains of E. coli, I don't know, do strains of E. coli, they probably differ by lots more than 100 amino acids because their genome's just a lot bigger. Yeah. I would say the way to think about it is that you've just, in that electron transport chain I just showed you, you brought in 100 amino acids all at once that are not used to interacting with their partners in the nuclear genome. And since I just told you that, I should actually say, you can do that in a fly, which already tells you that maybe this mitonuclear interaction isn't as strong because we could actually move 100 amino acids in and they were viable.
So when you do this with the mom from Simulans, what happens to the mom's nuclear DNA? I mean, don't you end up with
you get a hybrid, and then we use, in flies, we have these things called balancer chromosomes that let us precisely replace each of the nuclear chromosomes, and so that's how we were able to bring in two different nuclear backgrounds. Because if you want to test for epistasis, you need to have two types in the nuclear genome and two types in the mitochondrial genome to do that kind of reciprocal thing. Yeah.
So you inject the cytoplasm into the...
We cross them.
Oh, you cross them.
Yeah, injections actually, there's a lot of tricky things about that. That's the brute force part, because you got to get different species to hybridize, which is tricky on lots of levels because they don't like to do it. They behaviorally don't like to do it. And there's the potential for a lot of genetic incompatibility.
But there are other stuff in the cytoplasm other than just...
Yeah, we got rid of it. So, yeah, that's a good point. Especially in flies, they have an endosymbiont in their... Well, I don't know. We can get rid of it, so whether you want to call it endosymbiont. But they have Wolbachia in their cytoplasm. So, actually, you can't manipulate the mitochondria without manipulating everything else in the cytoplasm. So we clear them of their cytoplasmic bacteria before we do this. We're actually trying to reintroduce it now with injection.
And then you raise the embryos and then you do the essence.
Actually, no, we do a ton of genetics downstream, and these are stable genotypes now that we work with in the lab.
Is that like over generations?
Yeah, it's time? Because you brought the cytoplasm in from...
Because like Lehmann showed recently, right, like that, you know, once you start to have slight mitochondrial differences, during oogenesis, these kind of mitochondria get eliminated in the next generation.
They're not heteroplasmic. That's why we don't do injections. Yeah. Levels of detail that maybe not everybody, but yes, that's exactly why we did it by crossing. They're not heteroplasmic. Okay, what does it look like when we do this? What are we looking for? So we're looking for an epistatic, or actually, we're looking for a gene interaction. What does that look like in trait space? All right, so here I'm showing you mitochondrial genotype. So I've just picked three here. And then the two different symbols are the two different nuclear genomes that they inherited. And then this is development time. And you can see that there's a particular combination that extends development time by a few days, which when you're a Drosophila and it only takes you 10 to 12 days, a 2 to 3 day delay is really big. But you'll notice that that mitochondrial genotype functions perfectly well in the Austrian nuclear background, but seems to not work very well with this other genome. Those females also lay fewer eggs, and they have compromised sensory bristles. Those were actually all things that you can really see before you even quantified them. So this is a particularly strong interaction. We noticed it right away. We did some crosses to show that it's actually Mendelian inherited.
And it actually does not look like it interacts with other things in the nuclear genome. It actually looked like a great target for mapping. So I'll just tell you, it was 5 years of fine-scale mapping. Those of you who know about mapping might say, well, how do you map the mitochondrial genome? The mitochondrial genome has no recombination. And so what we did is, as we started the experiment, we actually substituted some simulans mitochondria that were quite similar to each other, but as a group were quite different from melanogaster. And those, I will just say in this plot I showed you before, these are both simulans mitochondria. They're very similar to each other. But they were both very different from melanogaster. So that was part of the design of the genetics experiment. And what that enabled us to do now is to say, what makes this genome different from this genome? And that's going to implicate a smaller number of mutations. And so I'll show you what those are. It's just five differences in the mitochondria that are compatible versus not compatible. And when I first did the sequencing and I got the results back, I was like, oh, wow, these are three synonymous substitutions. This is a substitution at a very non-conserved place in the ribosomal RNA. And this mutation in a tRNA, I'm showing you what it does here, it changes a GC, so your canonical Watson base pairing, to a GT, which, I don't know, it's actually okay. Those things like each other. So it's like right when I got my first tenure track job, I was like, oh boy, that's not good. None of those actually seem like good candidates. But we just persisted.
Christy?
Yeah.
Are those actually mutations that affect the phenotype, or are they just...
Well, we don't know. What they do is they distinguish the mitochondrial haplotype that is either compatible or incompatible. So we know that the five of them together do it. So what we did is we just persisted in doing the nuclear mapping, hoping that the nuclear candidate would tell us which of those is the best candidate.
Okay, so if you just sequence the mitochondrial genomes, you would have 100 changes?
Well, that was the trick that we used, is that between melanogaster and simulans, that's true, but we did multiple simulans mitochondria that we knew would be close to each other. And so if we saw differences among them, then we would be able to have a smaller subset of candidate mutations.
Okay, so how many mutations are actually...
Five.
How many positions are actually different between those two?
Five.
Okay, and those are the five?
Those are the five.
Okay, so that wasn't actually mapping, that was just sequencing to find those? Okay.
Yep. Yeah. All right, so we mapped the nuclear partner, and it turns out that it's a mitochondrial tRNA aminoacyl synthetase, meaning... It's a gene, and it happens to be the gene that is made in the nuclear genome that finds this tRNA in the mitochondria and puts its amino acid on it. So, I mean, that was, you know, maybe 3 years into my first tenure track job, that felt better. and so what it looks like is, this is just an alignment to show you how conserved they're called ARS proteins, like the pirate proteins. Nobody laughed at that one. Oh, no. Okay.
That was your punishment.
Yeah, really bad. All right, so this is a highly conserved position. This is showing you human, mouse, this is anopheles, and these are the drosophilids. So it's basically perfectly conserved, but it segregates in melanogaster as a polymorphism. And in fact, this is not a weird genotype. It's in 13% of we have a deeply sequenced population, so we can get good estimates of allele frequency. It segregates at about 13%. So that's actually pretty high. Most things segregate at low frequencies. So it's a polymorphism. It changes the amino acid. And then we did in flies, you can basically do rescue genetics. So with the paired incompatible mitochondria, you can express, you can insert into the genome and express, you can basically back mutate the allele, and it rescues the phenotype. So that's genetic evidence that this is indeed the phenotype. So in this example I'm showing you, now we actually know what's broken.
So it's low frequency, so I guess it's always in the wild, it's essentially always in heterozygotes.
It's in heterozygotes, but also remember,
so we have not found this mitochondrial mutation in any of the sequenced sets of melanogaster that are out there. Right, if these two mutations found each other in a natural population, I would say that the size of the fitness effect would probably eliminate one of the two. Yeah. But it's, so in natural populations, at least the flies sequences that are out there, we've not yet found this mitochondrial mutation. Although I should say that that mitochondrial tRNA state is, I think, in pseudo obscura. So it's not as if it can't happen or it doesn't happen. In our hands, the two mutations on their own seem pretty neutral. Like they don't have a big effect on traits. It's just the combination looks bad. Okay, so what does breaking that mitonuclear relationship do? I'll just sort of maybe go quickly through these sets of data to just kind of show you. Well, what happens? This is basically, I'm going to show you the genotype, phenotype, fitness map. So that mutation, you expect it should compromise protein translation in the mitochondria, right? It messes up putting the amino acids on the tRNAs. And there's a cool trick you can do with the mitochondria. There's one of those complexes, you've been introduced to it already, that doesn't require any protein translation from the mitochondria, and that's complex 2. And this genotype has normal activity of that complex. But for all the complexes, and I'm just showing you one here, that require protein translation in the mitochondria, they have low activity. So that supports that there's bad protein translation and that's compromising components of the OxPhos ETC chain. Okay, so this is a great model now, because if you're somebody who likes genetics and you're somebody who likes energetics, you have these four genotypes, the four combinations, and you're always just looking for how this genotype differs, right? And so we've done that, and we've done it across a lot of abiotic conditions. We've done it across life stages, different sexes. And the general pattern I'll just tell you is that the effects of that genotype always tend to be worse when we presume that the energy demand is high on the organism, which makes sense because the mutation breaks the supply chain, right? It's basically saying I can't give you as much ATP. And so if you put an organism in a condition where it doesn't need a lot of ATP, maybe it doesn't matter. But you put the organism in a condition where it needs a lot of ATP, then it should matter. That's sort of the summary of like all the data I'm going to show you next. But let me just show you what it looks like, because it's pretty dramatic. Okay, so the data I just showed you for development time, I'm just plotting it here in a different way, where really you're just looking to see whether the green triangle differs from the other genotypes. And it's on a longer, kind of a bigger scale here, so it's development time. We always, you know, we measure it at 25 C. It's like a standard temperature for fly geneticists. All right, if you beat them up, so you develop them at 28, that delay gets stronger, it gets bigger. But really, the miraculous thing is you take them to 16 degrees C, which is a totally fine temperature to be as a fly, and there's basically no interaction. There's no consequence. So if we think development time relates to fitness, it says the fitness effects of this pair of mutations matters when it's hot, but doesn't matter when it's cold. And so that gives you a sense of the kinds of complexity we're talking about with, you know, the genotype-phenotype relationship.
So, just an observation. It seems that one of them is becoming steeper with higher temperature. So it could be a chemical rate-driven process that probably makes it much more, the difference is much more sharp.
Yeah, I'm actually going to show you some data for...
I'm just reading from
Yep. Okay, so we wanted to... So I like to measure metabolic rate of things, and so I wanted to know whether there was whether that pattern was correlated with metabolic rates. So metabolic rate scales with mass, as you've already learned from some graphs, and so I always do all my statistics looking at the data this way. So this is a log-log plot, and it shows you that the green line, which is that disrupted genotype, at 16 degrees, so developed and measured at 16 degrees, it has a metabolic rate that looks perfectly normal for its nuclear genotype.
These are larvae, by the way, so if you are into respirometry, these are really tiny things in a respirometer. And what here I'm showing you is when you develop them at 25 degrees, where you see developmental delay, sort of to our surprise, this genotype is over-respiring.
Sorry, just a minute. The mass of these guys varies.
So I'm going to actually show you a scaling plot in a second. Mass does vary a lot because, particularly in the third instar of Drosophila, they are like putting on a lot of mass. Probably a lot of you know about Drosophila embryogenesis. It's like tightly controlled, right? It all happens in a very tight time frame. It's very canonical. But once you get further in development, there's actually quite a lot of variation in size. And these were not done in a particularly staged way. Actually, it helps you to have mass variation if you want to control for mass. Okay, so they're over-respiring. So our interpretation is that these are basically not very efficient developers. They're running a higher metabolic rate. Their development is slowed. So, you know, essentially, I think they're trying to maintain ATP homeostasis with a less efficient machinery. And that slows, they're basically having to burn more energy to make ATP, and that's coming from their energy stores. And development rate in flies is all about getting to be the right mass to commit to metamorphosis. It's a picture of my organisms. And you can notice right away, and this is another indicator that they're not energetically efficient, is that they can't actually climb very far. So when you're a Drosophila larvae, you live in a piece of fruit. This is our sort of simulated diet. And when it's time for you to pupate, you get out of that fruit, because that fruit is getting like grosser and grosser. And so what they do is they crawl away from the fruit. And in the vial, you can see that as like how high they climb. And that's actually well known from like classic mutant studies. Mutations that affect energy metabolism, they tend to have low pupation heights. And so you can see quite clearly that that genotype doesn't crawl very far. That's temperature dependent. At 16 degrees, they climb higher. Okay, so this is getting to your question a little bit. So I want to know, is it really about energy demand during development, or is it a direct effect of temperature? Because you could imagine that physical interaction between the tRNA and the synthetase, it just really doesn't work well at high temperatures where things are moving faster, but it works fine at 16 degrees or fine enough. So that's one hypothesis. And the other hypothesis is that when you are developing at higher temperatures, development is just going faster. And that's a more energetically demanding condition for the organism. So my grad student, Luke Hoekstra, had a great idea. And he said, let's try to change energy demand without changing temperature. And the way that you can do that in flies is by extending their photo period. So basically, you give them a full day photo period, and they just do everything faster. So they develop faster. So
what is photo period?
Oh, I'm sorry. Photo period is the amount of light they have in a given day. So normally we'll grow flies at a 12-12 light-dark cycle. If you grow them under full light, you can see most of the genotypes, they start to accelerate. They go faster. But this genotype doesn't. And so you can take that 16-degree condition where there was no phenotypic effect, and just by putting them in an environment that we think is increasing energy demand, we now see the phenotypic effects of that genetic interaction. And it's quite dramatic, actually, at 22 degrees. At 22 degrees, with a full light cycle, you actually get a stronger delay than we had seen at 25 degrees. So in some sense, it's temperature independent. It doesn't have to be temperature. You can change other things about the environment that sort of reveal that genetic effect.
I would say it's still dependent on temperature, because the temperature effect is much bigger.
Here, actually, the light cycle effect is much bigger. Like, the biggest developmental delay we see is actually, so it's both, right? I mean, but it's not a purely temperature-dependent interaction. I guess the effects of that interaction, even at the same temperature,
you can reveal them by changing the light cycle.
But maybe another way to say this is, it's what delta and temperature corresponds to what you are giving it. So this is a matter of energy balance, it feels to me like.
So that's good, because that's how I interpret it. Yeah. Right.
So the 25 degrees is not sufficient. Then the amount of photons you exposed it to at 22. Just an energy balance.
So you think it has something to do with time in general, maybe? Or like the time you, like, because I don't know if you, like, Richard Carthel just recently had this interesting paper where you, you know, you slow down, develop, like, metabolism in the fly, and it's like mutations who have detrimental effects of fly development at high metabolic rates seem to have no effect when you slow down metabolism. And one argument in that paper was that maybe you have longer amount of time to correct errors at lower, like, you know, at lower metabolic rates. So I was wondering whether it is a time or really a metabolism energetic effect.
Yeah. So I have a bunch of data that I'm not going to show you. I do think that there is an element of time here. So yes, I do. So there's data in my talk, but we're going to not get to it, where these genotypes are actually doing a lot of physiological compensation. They both seem to be turning on the Warburg, or relying on that Warburg effect that we've already heard about. So they make more lactate, and they turn up the TCA cycle. So they're doing a lot of physiological compensation, but I think the other compensation is just how much time you have to accumulate mass in the third instar. And yeah, a 16-degree fly, look how long it's taking to develop. I think that long development time does give it the capacity to eat until it can catch up. Yes. Yeah, it's a good point. And we make that argument, I think, in the paper. Yeah, so I think time is, you know, for an organism where development is fast, when you slow them down, it does give them more time to do what they need to do, independent of, like, slowing down metabolism.
So in the bottom of the dependence on temperature, it's just a all the reaction rate depend on temperature? Or are there any other temperature-dependent things?
Well, I think that what he just mentioned about kind of the time you get to develop, it's time-dependent, but yeah, it almost gives them like a buffer. They have a little bit more time to eat the mass.
No, I'm just saying, if a physicist trying to understand temperature dependence, can he assume that everything is in the rate dependent on temperature?
Actually, no. I'm going to show you right now. Actually, so I labeled this. This is one of my all-time favorite results that probably nobody will ever cite, except maybe people who really appreciate the temperature input into biochemical systems. Okay, so this result comes from the same data set. And so you can so under that developmental condition at 16 degrees, we saw that there wasn't an effect of that genotype, right, on development time or metabolic rate. But we measure all of our flies. We develop them at two different temperatures, 16 and 25, and we measure them at those two temperatures. And the reason we measure them at those two temperatures is because we like to estimate this thing called the Q10, which is how the metabolic rate responds to temperature in an ectotherm. And most, when you hear this described in your textbooks or by your physiology professor, it's really, they describe it as the energy going into the system increases the biochemical rates, and that increases metabolic rate. Like, it really seems described in that way. Here, what I'm showing you is that this genotype has, and it's significant, has a significantly reduced Q10 for its metabolic rate. It cannot increase its metabolic rate as high as other genotypes do in response to temperature. But if you develop at 25, it can. So what this tells you is that the developmental environment, something's happened to the physiology of this fly that constrains the way the temperature is coming into the system to affect metabolic rate. This, to me, I mean, probably no one will cite my paper for this. And probably most people wouldn't even put this in their genetics paper. But to me, it's a remarkable effect. It tells you that there is something about the organism, maybe it's mitochondria, maybe it's cells,
maybe tissue level, that's placing some constraint that does not allow metabolic rate to go up the way we think it should with temperature.
So this is the sort of the, I mean, in the other system, you want temperature compensation, so you want to kill Q10 to be very close to 1. And in this case, you actually want the metabolic rate to increase with temperature.
Well, want is kind of a weird word there. I do have kind of a biological, like one consequence of this that people have measured in insects is if you rear insects or ectotherms under a fluctuating environment, fluctuating thermal environment, their development rate does not look like development at the mean temperature. It looks like development at the higher temperatures. There's a pattern. There's a name for it.
How fast are these fluctuations relative to the development rate?
It's a very good question. I'm going to tell you why that's a good question in a second. So we thought, okay, what that means, the interpretation of that from a biological perspective is that the growth takes, like organisms are taking advantage of warm times to grow. And so if that's related to metabolic rate and the ability of metabolic rate to scale with temperature, then this genotype should not be able to do that. So we thought, oh, this would be a cool test of that. So we've tried rearing this genotype under fluctuating environments under at different frequencies, but mainly usually biologically relevant, like around its photoperiod, when it would in nature be seeing it. That genotype dies under fluctuating thermal environment. It dies.
Dramatic.
It's pretty dramatic.
And how big is the temperature amplitude you're using?
Between 16 and 25. Mm. Yeah. We've tried it actually quite a number of ways though.
So it should be Q9, not Q10.
Oh, I know. You could, yeah, this is, so yes, it's a Q9, and if you wanted to calculate the Q10, you actually have to like scale this a little bit. But these are like our incubator temperatures, and there's 9. I know. All right, I'm going to show you one more cool result, and then maybe we'll be done. I'm not going to get to the ecology.
So this temperature dependence on the metabolic rate, can you comment on how the similarities or differences with the how bacteria's growth rate depends weirdly on temperature, like it's not Arrhenius but goofy? Is this
emergent? So I have some papers with a colleague of mine, John DeLong. Actually, these are some of his data on the thermal performance curve for metabolic rate. So metabolic rates in ectotherms, they tend to go up with temperature, and at some point they come down. And neither the up or the down is adequately described by just like a pure Arrhenius equation. So John and I have fit data with curves that take the Arrhenius equation and try to modify it, but with like parameters that we're going to be able to interpret for biology. And so what we did is we sort of plugged in a thermodynamic, a temperature denaturation term. So proteins denature as temperature gets hotter. So Arrhenius makes things go faster, and temperature then, so what gives you the down curve? And so we basically made a modified Arrhenius equation and been fitting that to temperature performance curve data for flies, which I can, at the very end of my talk, I actually have some of that data. Yeah.
So
you can do it for prokaryotes, you can do it for eukaryotes, and you can do it for single-celled eukaryotes and multicellular and see like if the relationship differs and try to like build a model that has parameters that when you see that they differ, you might be able to relate back to the biology of prokaryotes versus eukaryotes is the goal. That's actually, we have some funding to work on that. Well, protists and multicellular eukaryotes.
I was just going to say that, at least in the bacterial context, there's a different curve called the Redkowski, which is Arrhenius-like in the middle, and then it captures these fall-offs on the little sides because of stuff getting too cold and stuff getting too hot.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about it because we actually are generating at the moment from like millions of flies a ton of thermal performance curves that need curves fit to them. And our model, I mean, it's published and it's okay, but the problem is that the parameters, like there's multiple combinations, like in the parameter space, there's multiple combinations that'll give you equally good fits. So I don't know. It's
I think it's a good try, but okay, I'm going to leave you with a scaling result because I don't know. I think people here might be interested in scaling. And also, just sort of gets to this idea about what scaling even means. So this is Kleber's relationship. I'm not even going to call it a law because I don't think it is a law. And this is some nice data from my colleague John showing you the metabolic scaling. So that these are log-log plots so that the slope of the line gives you the scaling exponent. Most of you are familiar with the three-quarter power law. It's been used to try to describe like all of ecology through fractal geometry. It's my like kind of loose understanding. And so that's, you can see that when you look across a broad spectrum of masses with metazoans. But if you look at protists, so single-celled eukaryotes, they scale with an exponent of 1. And if you look at prokaryotes, they actually scale with a slope greater than 1, meaning as they get bigger, their metabolic rate goes up per unit mass. Okay. I'm going to skip that one. That actually just tells you the developmental temperature of your fly affects its scaling. But here's maybe a result. So we had that kind of result, and I thought we need more data, and we need to know what's happening across development so that we have a nice mass range. So what I'm plotting for you is the scaling relationship of metabolic rate with mass within a species at 3 different larval life stages. It's not even like larvae versus adult. These are all larvae. And this is our first instar, and it scales with a scaling exponent greater than 1. So these are larvae, and their scaling exponent says as they get bigger, their metabolic rate is going up with unit mass. And then it flattens out, and they look like protists here when they're second instar, and then they're starting to converge on what looks like more of a multicellular scaling relationship. So Kleber's law, definitely not describing sort of dynamics of metabolic scaling in development of organism.
What R squared are these? You mean we have fit to the log?
Yeah. You mean what's the like the R squared? The yeah, it's good. It's for biological data. I
0.75.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is actually like
because it looks like a lot more scatter at the lower end. I mean,
oh, actually, yeah. I did not put the plot in. There is more scatter here. You know what explains it? It's genotype. So what I'm showing you, these are actually 10 different genotypes from which I've collected data. And there's, so if you look at the genotypes, there's a lot of spread amongst genotypes. There's a significant genetic effect here. It goes away. There's no genetic effect of genotype here. And then up here, you can actually see it when I plot all the genotypes together. Do you see how there's actually variation for the scaling. So once you get into the third instar, we see a lot more genotype-specific metabolic scaling, saying that genotype affects the not just your intercepts here. In the first instar, it affects your intercept, but out here in the third instar, there's genetic variation for the scaling.
So if I understand correctly, this horizontal map, the mass axis in your experiment is really time.
They are moving in that space over time.
Right. So another plot you probably have is that how does the mass change with time? Is it also a more or less a linear curve or exponential or power law?
Yeah, it's exponential.
Exponential.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
How would you align different flies on the plot?
Different what?
Flies. So.
Oh, on this plot.
The plot that Yuhai is asking for.
Yeah, so as the larvae develops over time, it experiences exponential mass growth.
And the x-axis there is just time measured since birth? Or you're scaling that in some way?
You could do it by day. You could do it by the time to reach, like, there's morphological. So you'll notice that their stage is not defined by their mass. So we actually, they have morphological ways that you can tell which instar they're in, and you can measure their mass, yeah. So you could do that axis in a number of different ways. Yeah, so maybe I'll leave you with that, and sort of highlighting where, you know, even, I guess what this kind of plot makes me real, well, first of all, it makes me do everything in 3 different instars now in flies, and I'll just say that our genotype that I've showed you, that mitonuclear genotype, has different effects in different instars. So I think maybe the take home from that is it's complex. But when you use these types of mechanistic approaches and you measure these things, then you might be able to start coming up with mechanistic models for why that's the case. So for example, on the scaling plot, early in development, we know from developmental biology that most of the growth of the organism is cell proliferation. Right? Well, so these are doing, and they're actually running a different metabolism. They're using more of that type of Warburg-like metabolism. Later in development, most of the growth is due to individual cell growth and putting on lipid mass, like storage mass, and that's actually metabolically not very active tissue. All right, so we might be able to see these patterns and understand why the relationship between your mass and your metabolic rate, which some people have called a law, changes. And is it changing, how much of that is stochastic and how much is genotype and how much of it, I think, some of it may be stochastic. You take the same genotype and you probably have a distribution of individuals, that are setting down different Waddington. I never really thought I would use the Waddington metaphor, but maybe setting you on slightly different paths.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. So you said early stages of proliferation is more Warburg effect, but is that measurement actually effectively carbon dioxide production rate? So that's not measuring Warburg effect, right? That's actually also measuring the oxflux.
This is measuring CO2 output. I actually measure lactate.
Right. So that's Warburg effect. So this is also arguing the oxflux.
They do both. Okay, so yeah. So I should say, in development, flies have to use oxygen. So a lot of their metabolism is running. They're making a lot of ATP by glycolysis, but they are all respiring oxygen. You cannot knock out oxphos in flies. They won't live.
If you think about it in an organism where does lactate go, right? If that lactate is again used by other cells in oxidative phosphorylation, the sum of both of these, of the oxidative phosphorylation, should still give you the total level, right?
Oh, yeah. I see what you're pointing. So this does read out, it doesn't read out all your metabolism, right? That's what you're doing with indirect calorimetry, or with direct calorimetry. But indirect calorimetry is an output of both of those metabolisms together. Yeah.
So I'm going to see if we're doing a lot of storage. For example, if I'm a lactate that does not burn away, eventually it becomes glycogen in the end. Because they are going mass, right? So that's part of it. So that's a little complexity there.
Well, and we don't actually know where the lactate goes. It's still pretty new days for this type of understanding the role of this metabolism in development. So I work on that with my colleague, Jason Tennyson, and we still don't actually know how much of that lactate really gets recycled. Lactate is, we think of it as a toxic byproduct. Are they excreting it? We're trying to figure out if it affects their microbiome. It's early days for understanding that pathway in the flies. Yeah. All right, so maybe I'll let people go. I'm happy to stay and talk about any of this, and find me throughout the next few weeks. But other than that, I think we should break for lunch.